Some four centuries after their reigns, Queen Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots, seem more like icons than actual flesh-and-blood women. Elizabeth is the stern virgin queen. Mary, her beautiful cousin, is a romantic who died a Catholic martyr. Last year in England, a book came out that explored not so much the lives of these two queens, but the life of their highly charged and very human relationship. Called Elizabeth and Mary, it's written by celebrated biographer Jane Dunn, who's written previous biographies of Mary Shelley and Virginia Woolf. Elizabeth and Mary has just been published here, and book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The age-old question of how a woman in politics is supposed to behave came to the fore last week when Dr. Judy Steinberg Dean was criticized for behaving as though she still had a right to an autonomous private life, while her husband, Howard Dean, was busy campaigning for the Democratic nomination for president. Dutifully, Dr. Steinberg Dean responded by materializing at her husband's side, smiling and clapping with the good wifely gusto of a Hillary or a Laura. I was disappointed at Dr. Steinberg Dean's capitulation. I complained to a friend, "The government should just appoint Harvey Fierstein to be permanent first lady. He did such a good job female impersonating Mrs. Santa Claus in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, and he could really carry off those little red suits and that helmet hairdo and the adoring gaze first ladies are supposed to wear. I thought I was being so clever. Then I read Jane Dunn's fascinating biography, Elizabeth and Mary, about the vexed rivalry between Queen Elizabeth I and her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots. It turns out Queen Elizabeth was way ahead of me in hitting upon the mixed messages of androgyny as a strategy to navigate her way through the overwhelmingly masculine world of Renaissance politics. In response to vicious critics like John Knox and John Calvin, who pronounced female rulers monstriferous and her reign a deviation from the primitive and established order of nature, Dunn says Elizabeth declared that she was possessed of a mystical sexual duality. Though she had the natural body of a woman, frail, flighty, and flirtatious, she also possessed the maleness inherent in her body politic, the heart of a lion and the mind of a scholar. In contrast, poor Mary, Queen of Scots, who ruled in a strictly feminine manner by relying on her sexuality and her husband's and male admirers to achieve her political ambitions, wound up literally losing her pretty little head. Both queens explicitly reflected in letters and other documents on their conundrum as women in power, a subject that makes Dunn's elegantly intertwined biography of their relationship feel so contemporary. At the same time, Dunn also invokes a substantive vision of a superstitious and bloody Renaissance world that's impossibly weird and distant, a world where torture on the rack or assassination by poisoning were everyday political realities. The gist of her scrupulously detailed argument is that Elizabeth and Mary, who never once met in person, were hyper-aware of each other from childhood, and that in part they fashioned themselves as rulers and as women in reaction to each other. Mary, who was Elizabeth's junior by 9 years, was brought up in the glittering Catholic French court, where she was encouraged to believe that she was the legitimate heir to the English throne, rather than Elizabeth, the daughter of that Protestant Jezebel, Anne Boleyn. Mary married 3 times, each succeeding husband more virile and dastardly than his predecessor. Elizabeth's early and dogged allegiance to celibacy, despite her passion for the Earl of Leicester, allowed her to maintain her independence while strategically dangling her hand in marriage for decades to eligible foreign monarchs. Yet, as Dunn points out, Elizabeth's canny political choice was surely also motivated by the spectacle of grotesque marriages, her mother's and father's chief among them, she witnessed from childhood. Marriage, family, and political entanglements noted, Dunn says that the turbulent relationship between the two queens was the most important connection of both their lives. Even towards the end of their joint story, as Elizabeth held Mary her prisoner for 19 years on suspicion of treason, a charge that would result in her beheading, Elizabeth attested to the emotional thrall her cousin held her in, declaring, "I am not free but a captive. Dunn's astute psychological reading of the relationship between the two queens never oversteps into the realm of glibness or sensationalism. And after all, there's plenty of R-rated material inherent in even a bare-bones account of Mary and Elizabeth's reigns. There's also a fair amount of humor here, an element that humanizes Elizabeth in particular. Dunn tells the story of the Earl of Oxford, who returned to Elizabeth's court after 7 years of self-imposed exile, after having embarrassed himself in front of the Queen. The mischievous Elizabeth greeted him with the words, "My lord, I had forgot the fart." It's hard to imagine a woman in the political spotlight these days saying anything in public remotely so ribald. Harvey Fierstein, maybe. The First Ladies Club, never.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Elizabeth and Mary by Jane Dunn. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.